Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. Each week, we dive into crime stories reported by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the nation. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. We'll hear about a mass shooting that has been linked to artificial intelligence, ongoing efforts in Buffalo, New York to heal from the 2022 Tops supermarket mass shooting, and a new program in Minnesota aimed at reducing fatal shootings. Before allegedly shooting five children dead at a secondary school in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, and injuring others, 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootselaar also allegedly shot and killed her mother and her half-brother at her home, according to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The teen later died of a self-inflicted injury. Van Rootselaar was using OpenAI's artificial intelligence-powered chatbot, ChatGPT, before the shooting. The CBC reported that her account had been banned for, quote, disturbing content, and law firm Rice Parsons Leone and Elliott claims that 12 different OpenAI employees asked the company to warn Canadian law enforcement about her. Now, the firm is suing OpenAI in California. Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo discussed the case with crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett this week.
Sam, we're taking a look at what we keep hearing more and more of, Brad, and that is AI, ChatGPT, some of these other artificial intelligence programs being used in, or at least being looked at before a crime happens or may have happened. And we're all kind of wondering, well, shouldn't this raise a red flag? What can we do about it? What do we know about this, Brad?
So if you think about the number of people that say bad things and maybe facilitate or try to facilitate AI to help them, you know, I don't know how big that number would be. You would think if somebody goes on AI, says, I want to shoot up my school, and then the AI helps them figure out what's the best type of weapon, when's the best time to go to school, how to get to school, how to exit the school, and maybe even help you write a manifesto, you would think, obviously, that's a huge red flag. The question is, there's a lot of AI companies. We know about the big ones, like OpenAI, that I think I discussed in my pitch. That they're being sued by some folks in the British Columbia because of a mass shooting there. there's a real issue about where the AI companies can draw a line. The example I just gave, you'd think that would be a no-brainer, but you also have to have the mechanism to do that. I mean, they're trying to monitor like potentially millions of people at the same time. You know, and they primarily do that with algorithms, not listening to what people or reading what people are writing or whatever it might be. But, you know, it's a pretty daunting task. But having said that, is it worth not doing it and then getting sued?
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
And clearly it's a judgment call, I think, to a certain extent by the AI companies as to, does this really meet a threat? Threshold, or is this person just talking talk? It's a tough call, I think, sometimes. But don't be surprised if you see more and more of these lawsuits where people are alleging that AI could have stopped a potential shooter and didn't.
But do we know if AI, being so intelligent, if AI could stop the shooters before they opened fire?
Well, I can only, the short answer is no, you can't stop a person from doing whatever they're going to do, but you can certainly not facilitate or help them do what they are saying they want to do. So I think the question you're asking me is AI, the contributor, the motivator? It's really hard to say. I mean, logic would say in some cases it appears to be the case, but can you say that for sure? The answer is no. If you're determined to commit a mass shooting, obviously we had plenty of mass shootings before there was AI. And people find, websites, they find individuals, they find groups to help legitimize / rationalize what they want to go do. So all I'm suggesting is we do need to figure out better ways to monitor to stop some, it would appear to be pretty obvious, would-be mass shooters.
There's two things to this, Brad. There's one, what you just mentioned, monitoring this. I mean, you'd think it should be easy enough to throw up a red flag. But then the other is the programming here, and thinking specifically of ChatGPT, where, I mean, it constantly, and, we could be talking about a shooter or we could be talking about something else here. It constantly is validating people who are putting things into it. It's constantly, encouraging people, offering words of encouragement. It seems like a programming or design flaw, or maybe it's on purpose, we don't really know, where it's just, it's acting like your best friend, your cheerleader in the corner, no matter if you're trying to drop 10 pounds or do something heinous.
So you've hit a direct point that is what it does, but that's why people use it. You don't want to go on a website that then beats you up because, you don't want to do that. What's wrong with you? They want a soft, compassionate, literate voice that guides them through depression, relationship issues, whatever it might be. And so, there's a real attraction to that, which then does two things. It A, attracts more people, and B, it attracts you to go use it more. And the last thing they need is to be hard-nosed on the front end, so to speak, because people will just go someplace else because there's a lot of competition now within the AI world.
We're today remembering the Topps mass shooting here in Buffalo took 10 lives 4 years ago today. And there are lawsuits in this case against social media companies for influencing the shooter. But what the cases have in common with what you're talking about with AI is that outside factors figure in many of these attacks, right?
Well, that's right. And I assume the lawyers for the AI companies will point that out, and rightly so. We'll see. But, don't be surprised if you see more lawsuits as time goes on, because it's a logical, rational place, if you're a would-be shooter, to go to help you figure out how to best commit this horrible act.
In Buffalo, WBEN has covered the impact of a mass shooting, the 2022 Topps supermarket massacre, for years. Then 18-year-old Peyton Gendron allegedly shot 13 people, killing 10. A manifesto from Gendron indicated that it was a racially motivated attack. 11 of the 13 victims were Black. And research has connected the case to online radicalization. Thursday marked the 4-year anniversary of the massacre, and Gendron is still awaiting a federal trial with a possible death penalty. Meanwhile, the community is still healing from the loss. Reverend Mark Blue, chair of the 514 Memorial Commission, provided an update on those efforts to heal the community in an interview with WBEN this week.
How are you remembering today?
Well, I'm remembering today as a day, not only a somber day, but also a day in which progress is being made on the 514 Memorial Healing Center. We are sending out all of our prayers to all of the families, and not only the families of those lives that were stolen from us, but also the survivors, the individuals that were in the TOPS and in the surrounding area. It's going to be a day in which we will always remember for the rest of our lives, but we want to just be encouraging to those families and letting them have their moment of grief and not try to put more on them. So we are remembering this as a somber occasion, but also an occasion in which we have learned to persevere through.
Reverend, many people are taking part in a day of service today. Many will be at the remembrance at 2 o'clock this afternoon at the TOPS store. But for those not going to be there, what do you want them to do today or to think about?
Take time for themselves, because everybody's healing process is different. Their grieving process is different. Take time for yourself. Have that moment of reflection, which we will always have. But it's, self-maintenance is very important. We need to take time for ourselves. We don't do that enough. This time, this day has always been full of activities. But for those who are going through and grieving, take time for yourself. Take time with your family. Enjoy your family.
You mentioned that there is progress being made on the 514 Memorial. There's a lot of questions as to, you know, what exactly is being done there and where this process is. What can you tell us about what happened this week?
Well, this week we did hire a construction manager, and the construction manager will help us to really get the accurate estimates as and timetable for when the Monument Memorial Healing Center can be built. We'll have more actual and real numbers that we can give out to the community so they'll know exactly how much it will cost for this to happen. And we're looking at roughly about, and maybe within the next 2 to 3 months, we will have another update on real cost. And also, we are in the soft phase of our capital campaign. So it's moving quite rapidly compared to other memorials and that have been done. We have had the advantage, and I say that not happily, but I say we've had the advantage of looking at what others have done and not duplicating some of the errors or mistakes or pitfalls that they ran into, because we've been talking to them. And by having that communication, we were able to move at a much more rapid pace because, unfortunately, of the tragedies that has happened in our past in our country.
This memorial will be built at Jefferson and Best, and I realize you don't have the true cost of it, but how much money has been raised, and what is the goal right now?
Well, the goal is to raise as much money as we can, but right now we have about $7 to $8 million that has been committed to the project, and we are hoping to raise another 15 to 20 million, because we would like for this not only to be done one time, but to be maintained and taken care of in forever and perpetuity. So, you know, it's a fundraising venture that will happen on a regular basis, because we want to make sure that our community is being serviced and that it's not just a one-time incident of a building being done and then forgot about. But, you know, we're trying to raise as much as we can to make sure that it is taken care of in perpetuity.
You know, we've reached the point now where it's been so long, there's been so many meetings, there's been so much money involved, that a lot of people are wondering, you know, hey, why haven't we just used this money for something else to better the community instead of this memorial project? You mentioned not just being a building. How, in your mind, is this memorial going to be a benefit to the surrounding community?
Well, it will be a place of solace, a place where people can heal, a place where people can reflect, a place where people can learn. We will be partnering with other organizations to have different services at this particular site on Jefferson and Bess, which we haven't had in the past. It will be a place where even artists can show their works. So it's going to be a ever evolving place in which we can come and learn and come and receive any of the services that we need for the community. We're not trying to be a first. We're trying to bring other entities and other organizations together for healing. We also want this to be a place where even the schools can come and learn about what has happened and learn how we can be a vehicle and a pinnacle to teach that racism is learned behavior and it can be unlearned. So it's going to be a great place, not only locally, but I believe even internationally, people will come and see how we persevered and how we made a difference in our community to help eradicate racism and the prejudices that are in our society.
You know, Reverend Blue, you always say that you have one chance to get this right. With that said, are you satisfied with every decision that's been made so far?
Yes, I am, because it's heavily community involved. We're doing focus groups even currently right now. At the very beginning of this, we started by having the community share their input as to what needs to be done for our community, for healing, for our community, for uplifting. As you can see, a lot of things are happening on Jefferson right now, and community redevelopment. So it fits. This is going to be a place where people will want to come and want to share not only their experiences, but even have physical activity, even have yoga. There's a lot of unlimited possibilities in which we are still developing for this site and for this building. It will be used all year round. And one of the things that we need to do is to know that our children need this learning opportunity as well as our adults to help in the grieving process. So, you know, we are working with heavily community input as to what we're doing and going forward.
In Minnesota, authorities are taking a new approach towards reducing fatal shootings. It starts with investigating non-fatal shootings. Here's Ramsey County Attorney John Choi explaining this new program in an interview with Jason DeRusha of Odyssey Station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities.
How does investigating non-deadly shootings lead to maybe answers in actual homicide?
Yeah, because I think that we're sending the wrong message if we don't solve these crimes. And then let's talk about why this was. A lot of times, you know, in our communities, we have retaliatory violence, cyclical violence. So when the police officer shows up to the emergency room and the person is recovering from their gunshots, they don't want to participate in their own investigation and prosecution.
Because it's gang, it's like gang stuff where somebody...
Yeah, there's retaliatory violence, and they don't believe that the system is going to keep them safe, and so it's better for them to keep themselves safe and then exact right. whatever revenge they're going to do. So this just perpetuates, especially in urban jurisdictions all across America. But if we were to take an approach to say that we're going to investigate and prosecute these cases regardless of whether or not the victim participates, and by the way, we do that all the time for a homicide, right? There is no victim. We figure out how to solve these cases so we can do the same thing for these cases. And so the effort and the initiative is just to really treat these cases like a homicide. The St. Paul police created their own separate unit, not the homicide unit. It's a separate non-fatal shooting unit. They go out immediately as soon as there are shots fired. And then we also created a victim a witness emergency fund and the theory of change there is that if we could take care of some of the basic needs of individuals around safety, maybe later they will participate. But we're assuming that they're not going to participate. And we're developing and getting all of the evidence that you can get, like cell phone location, video cameras, all of those things, and we're just on it right away and treat them like a homicide. And that's why these results,
the response is sort of the same, right, John? Like the police department sends out the same kind of cavalry that they would if it,
yep.
Now in St. Paul there were only 15 homicides, right? So does that make it more
think
doable?
About the year before, but think yeah, about the year before
more,
there were 32,
right,
32 homicides, and then we got it down to 15, and I know it's because of this. I mean, just the shots fired in our town, I mean, it went down from 183 to 73.
Yeah.
In terms of non-fatal shootings.
The results are unbelievable. Are they better than you expected?
Yeah, we were just thinking if we could get it over 50%, because our model was Denver, and they got it up to 50% after a year. We thought we'd be doing great, and wow, we're at like above 70%, and we've been doing that for the last 2 years.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, KRLD 1080 in Dallas, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, The Tara Show out of 98.9 Word in Greenville, South Carolina, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, and WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to tell you about a new podcast from Odyssey called Family Lore. It's about interesting family stories and the truth behind them. It's available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.